Hey guys, this is your host Nitin Binhani and a very warm welcome to my startup podcast channel Jazair Audio, where we share real stories with real learnings. According to Wall Street Journal, every 3 out of 4 funded startups still fail. In fact, sources such as Medium.com and CB Insights periodically publish the postmortem of almost 300 to 500 startups who, despite raising billions of dollars, still failed. And so in today's podcast, I invited Alexandre Covello, the VC partner at Defrocked VC, which is based in UK, to share his valuable insights on how to effectively scale up from seed to series A round, what kind of pitfalls to watch out for, and what should founders do when not fundraising. So, let's welcome today's special guest. Hi, Alexandre. Welcome to Jazair Audio and thank you for talking to us.
Very happy to be with you. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with, you know, with 75% of the funded startups still ending up as failures, what are the key reasons or the common reasons behind them?
So there are two ways to answer your question. If you take it from a VC perspective, VCs see their investments as a diversified portfolio. So to a certain extent, you know, in a VC, in a normal VC portfolio, you will end up having maybe 20 or so companies that you back. And I think historically, 80% or 70% of that portfolio would not perform very well, or as you said, would fail. And so I guess from the VC perspective, as soon as you identify companies that you funded in the same way, performing more than the others, those are the ones you're going to be willing to push. Because some of those outliers might be, as we say, fund returners. And I guess the rule that we like to use is, like we'd say, 20, 30, 50. So 20% of a portfolio will return most of the investments, 30% will be, you know, in between doing okay, and 50 will not work. So I guess the first part of the answer is that this is the way it works, because at the beginning of a story, there are always risks embedded with what you do as an entrepreneur. The other way to answer your question is, what is, you know, as a founder, what made me fail even though I've raised money? I think it's lacking two things, really. Is being able to identify earlier on your product market fit. So, you know, when you start a business, you start with a problem. You see something that's not working, and as an entrepreneur, you want to solve. Then you build a product or a solution around that problem, and then you raise money on that story. And VCs like to invest into those equity stories. They like stories. Once you've done that, finding the proper market fit where, you know, customers will buy your solution, will really identify with the pain point that you thought of in the first place. That's where companies fail, because more often than not, that product market fit will not be there. So, you know, the idea, the problem you identified in the first place will not be as big, or people will not react in the way you expected them, or your solution is not answering that problem in a particular way. So it's really that product market fit, which I think is the inflection point and where, you know, founders should be focused on. And to conclude, if VC sees that product market fit is not there and they've invested earlier on, they'll probably pass, and they'll probably not follow on that company, and will focus on those that have found that magical moment of product market fit.
So what is the journey like from seed to series A round? What kind of changes takes place?
Right. I think, like I said before, it's really a change of mindset. You're going from, you know, solving a problem you identified and built a product for, to building a proper company. You go from, you know, I built a product, something that's working, we're 3 people, CTO, CEO, CMO. Now we need to build an organization. We need to build a culture. So again, it's going from, you know, what we've just discussed about the MVP to the product market fit, to going to the third acronym, which is, you know, GTM, which is building your go-to market. And it's interesting because people think about, you know, they think about that inflection point in terms of people hired or money raised. So, you know, they will say, I've done a Series A round, and I raised so much on that valuation. That is some sort of a metric. Or we went from the founding team to 10 people or to 20 people. I think, you know, the journey here is really about building, not hiring your 10 first employees, but building the 10 first systems that are basically going to structure your business, build the culture on which, you know, the company will grow thereafter. So in a sense, you need to think about your business in the same way as you've built your initial product. And I guess, you know, to back to your initial question, why do people fail? I think one way not to fail is to say, in the same way that you've built your MVP, you want to be building your company as a product and have the 10 most important features, structures that help you, you know, build a company in the same way. And I think, you know, the key thing at that moment, which is not always understood by everybody, because you're very much hands-on on the product, on trying to attract the first clients, doing your POCs, is really building that culture where because, you know, the first hires will be part of that culture that you're establishing. And so you need to be putting the foundations to build a scalable system to enable, you know, the founding team, the first employees, but also, you know, the next 90 employees when you go from 10 to 100 to continue building the company in a strategic way.
So how should founders effectively scale up from seed to Series A round?
So I think, you know, in terms of practical things that you can do, so the first one is, again, is on building the organization. And building the organization goes very much around, I would say, three things. One is strategic planning. How do you plan for the future? And it's not only the business plan that you're presenting to, you know, your board or your VCs or to yourself. It's really planning long-term and knowing that, you know, there will be milestones. And so you will be, each fundraise will be to achieve a milestone. And so you need to have at least one or two, three milestones identified in the first place. The second thing is very much around knowledge management. I think companies that you see succeed and go to, you know, to unicorn status are companies that are very early on moving into, you know, capturing all the knowledge which is with the founding team and basically putting that at the disposal of, you know, of future employees and future comers. And then the third thing is, which is paramount as well, is being able to communicate at 360, it's communication, communicate with all constituencies, again, your VCs, your board members, your clients, your employees. So that is very much the third key point around building the organization. Now, there is another point which I think is key as well, which people tend to forget, is what we mentioned before around the go-to-market. I like to say that fundraising or, you know, fundraising milestones or series are very much linked to your sales pipeline and to your growth. And I think it makes sense. But I guess the issue here is that you need to be raising money to implement your next stage of growth. And at the same time, that stage of growth needs to be documented and introduced to your funders, to your, you know, future investors. And I guess, you know, having that playbook well written, well understood, where you are, once you raise money, you are on execution mode, is also paramount to success. The third thing, and I'll stop here, which, you know, people tend to forget, is hiring. Building your team. There was a study recently that showed that the difference between companies that made it to unicorn status to others that didn't was very much the pace of hiring. Most of the unicorns, or all of the unicorns, were on a very disciplined and almost military hiring plan, where the founders were hiring a senior VP for whatever function almost on a quarterly basis. So think about it. You need to be hiring one VP, four VPs per year over a period of 3-4 years. That's really the building block of your management team, which you need to build in 3 to 4 to 5 years. If you don't do that, if you hire like one person per year, then you're lagging behind. And I think, you know, in the end, that's why talent is so paramount to the growth of a business. So to conclude on this, if you go back to your initial point, you know, when you start an MVP and you're a smart, maybe technologist or CTO, and you've came up with a cool product and you find your product market fit, then it's very much about building that organization and being able to sell to clients in a very structured way with a plan which is documented and understandable, and also hire the right people that will basically bring you from 3 people to maybe 500 people if you're a people intensive business. But, you know, more often than not, if you grow very strongly, you will have people on the bench, and hiring and managing will become, and leadership will become, a key skill required for you as a founder, and that comes earlier than not.
And while scaling up, what are the pitfalls to watch for and how to take care of them?
I guess the short answer to your previous question was you need to have a plan and a compass and a North Star. I guess one of the pitfalls is to be it is not to be adaptable and not to adjust that plan to reality. And I think one of the issues, you know, why sometimes from seed to series A or even from series A to series B, you basically get stuck into, you know, initial growth is, I would say, easy. There is a metric which we, in terms of growth, which is to say it's treble, double. So you need to treble your turnover on year one, treble year two, and then double. But to achieve that kind of growth, you need to keep that pace, you need to keep that rhythm, you need to keep that momentum. And again, you know, when you sit on boards or when you basically help founders to identify their KPIs, their OKRs, this can get quite technical. But I think it's very much like, you know, the rhythm, the pace at which you continue implementing them. If you start slowing down, if you stale, then, you know, it's not one pitfall. It's like suddenly you start losing the rhythm and the pace at which other companies, especially in your own, you know, on your own space, are growing. And that's when suddenly you become, instead of being like a leader in your segment or in your industry, you start, you know, losing clients, losing people. And then instead of being on a growth path or an hyper-growth path, you start, you know, having to handle more and more issues. And I think those are, we could list them, but they become like natural pitfalls of not being able to maintain the rhythm of the growth you initiated in the first place when you raise your first round of funding.
So are you hinting at a sustainable, aggressive growth?
So it doesn't have to be aggressive. I think it has to be sustained. It needs to be sustained in the sense that it needs to be sustainable and it needs to be continued. It needs to be a continued effort without stopping. If you stop and go, it becomes difficult. It becomes difficult for two reasons, and we're going back to the reasons why, you know, startup fail. First one is like if your backers, if your VCs are seeing some difficulties, they'll try to help you. But if they see that you're not growing as expected, they'll probably dedicate resources and time to other things. And probably, you know, it's just a temporary issue, but more often than not, you know, what happens is after 2 to 3 years of growth, you realize that, you know, actually there is not enough room to grow as fast and as high as you thought in the first place. And that's when, you know, you become some sort of a going concern as opposed to, you know, an hyper-growth company that can basically, you know, get some sort of power law effect and grab big market shares.
And what if for some reason any startup couldn't raise Series A? What should the founders do then?
So it's an interesting question, and I think there are two parts of it. So the first one, I'd like to say that there are increasingly a number of founders that are trying to stay away from VC money. So, you know, some of them will want to raise, you know, the multi-million dollars rounds, and they'll, and fundraising will be metrics of success, and we know most of them. But, you know, there is a big debate about should you raise money. As soon as you start to have turnover, you know, to have revenues, you can grow on your own unless you have like very big capital requirements, working capital requirements, you can grow on your own. So I think the fact that, I guess what I'm saying is that some founders are trying to grow their businesses, you know, on some sort of hyper growth pace, but without money. So I guess what I'm hinting to is that there are ways of growing the business without injecting too much cash into it. And some people are doing that quite successfully. And the good thing about this is obviously the trade-off that they're getting is that they're getting less diluted. And so at exit, as founders, they have like more of a company and then they would have with external funding. So I guess to answer your question is like, you know, what is it that you can do if you hit a wall? And I think there are many things that can be done. And in my experience, I've seen, it's interesting because, you know, with the pandemic, I've seen quite a few situations where people had gone to probably Series B, you know, with big companies and lots of people on the bench. And then suddenly, because of the pandemic, you know, the entire business model collapsed. So they had to go back to square one, you know, back to the, you know, seed round, but it's more to the again, refinding the product market fit, downsizing the team, and reinventing a business based on what they had. Those moments are always very painful because, you know, you've grown fast, things have been going very well. Suddenly, you lose your business. The good thing is that more often than not, you have some assets in the business that can be the product, could be some clients, could be the team itself. If you're able to adjust and rebuild on that and accept that, you know, you went one step back to go faster forward, very often those companies are able to do that, become very successful. They need to be trusted and followed, again, by all constituencies, their investors, their team, their clients. But when they're able to reset, they tend to perform extremely well. And so those resets are always a bit scary, but they happen. And it's really a management skill to be able to find, you know, once you find product market fit, which is never easy, and you've been successful and you were building the organization, suddenly to say, that's not working. Okay, let's find another PMF and continue growing in another direction. It's like anything in life. But I think, you know, the very good founders are able to adjust very quickly on that front.
Finally, could you share a brief on your venture, DeFrog VC, which is quite a unique name, I must say. And what is its investment thesis?
Absolutely. It's interesting because DeFrog VC, a lot of my colleagues VCs, they don't like it. They say, you're not being very nice to the profession. But I guess DeFrog was a joke that started like during the pandemic because, you know, I ended my last program of investments. So I was technically fundless and I started advising. I had to basically help some of my portfolio companies. And so I started advising some companies without money. In a sense, it's like bringing the smart money. So because I couldn't make checks, which is sometimes, you know, how you get into deals and you get a seat at the table, and you get a board seat and people, you know, go on listening to what you have to say. I became defrocked. I had to basically convince founders that, you know, whatever I had to say or ideas that I could bring to the table were worth listening. And so I think, you know, that defroc period is, I really enjoyed. I really enjoy it because that put me more on par with founders. I very much appreciate the efforts we're doing in building businesses, which is always extremely difficult. So that's how the DeFrog name came. And I guess to answer your question, so far it's still very much value-based investing. So I'm providing services and help as opposed to cash. But we are in the process of raising a new fund. We'll be focused again on financing European companies because we are based in Europe between Paris and London with the aim to help them in their international expansion. I don't know how many French or Italian or Spanish companies you see in India, probably not that many. For the time being, you know, founders are very much focused on US expansion, which makes perfect sense. But I think, you know, there is a need for European companies, A, to be working more amongst themselves, you know, the French with the German and with the Italians or even, you know, in more of Central Europe. And then they need to be thinking about their products in a more international way. They tend not to be as international as one would think. And so one thing we would like to do with our investment thesis is to be pan-European, to invest into companies across Europe, but very early on, help them expand west to the US, but also, east to Asia, China if possible, and definitely India, which is nice. A huge market. And some are doing it already very successfully.
So with this, we have reached at the end of this podcast. Alexandre, it was a pleasure to have you on Jazeera Audio and thank you for sharing great insights with us.
Very happy to. Again, thank you for having me and looking forward maybe to another one when things get better. Thank you very much, Nitin. Much appreciated.
Lastly, I want to thank all the listeners who took their valuable time to listen to this podcast. Keep rocking, be safe, and don't forget to share.